The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another FIA Group webinar. As always, it is the FIA Group CEO, Adam Russo, here. With me, as usual, is Jen McCormick, John Javelin, and Ron Peck. Say hello, guys.
Hello, guys.
Hello. I knew he was going to do that.
A wise guy.
Folks, we typically take off July and August from the webinars, but based on the popular demand, the fact that we have a great crowd again today, we figured it makes sense for us to keep these things going all throughout the year. So even though Ron had to come back from his vacations quicker than normal, I'm sure he doesn't miss being back at work rather than home with his crying baby. Is that right?
I haven't changed the diaper all day, Adam.
Fabulous. So we're excited about this webinar called Back to Basics, Plan Language 101 Part 2. Basically, we're going to cover everything we did not have time to cover last month, as well as a bunch of stuff that we have been emailed or texted about from you folks on things that you want us to bring up for this particular webinar. Just know that, as always, you can always send us a question. You have that little box that you can send us questions, and if we have time or if we think that the question is worth repeating or if we're allowed to repeat it, we will make sure that we bring that up at the end. By the way, the next webinar will be on August 23rd, 2016. In this amazing webinar, what we are going to do is basically go through a RAP network contract and rip it apart paragraph by paragraph, line by line, advising you what you could do and not do when it comes to RAP claims and how some of these organizations are taking advantage of you and your plans for a nice big ride of money. So with that, I want to make sure I bring up the fact that we have a special email, as you all know, a PGC referral at fiagroup.com. Last month, in the month of June, we received 384 requests, 384 different emails about everything from plan drafting to ACA compliance to provider issues, stop-loss complaints, client disputes, balance billing issues, you name it. As always, feel free to let us know. To give you an idea, it's gone up by about 170% from this time last year, so more and more people are using it. And based on that, what we can tell you is that in the month of June, these four things were the most frequently asked questions. And as always, our fan favorite, the reason why 90% of the people dial in, we have brought Jen McCormick back to talk about June's most frequently asked questions. So take it away, Jen.
Awesome. All right. So these are the four topics that we have seen the most throughout the month of June, and I just wanted to give you a little bit of background about these questions and actually some responses and things that hopefully you can take home. So the first is talking about prescription drugs. We're talking about the exclusions and the discrimination issues. So first, we know that a specialty drug is generally everything or anything that is $600 or more, and that's what Medicare defines as a specialty drug. We know that there are special rules about essential health benefits, and with essential health benefits, we cannot put any sort of dollar limitation on a benefit and have a compliant plan. So we need to be creative in the way that we are designing and containing costs for prescription drugs. So we can do this in a way that would be uniform and make sure that it is across an entire class of drugs and not specifically targeting any sort of specific disease. And also, when we're talking about specialty drugs, there is a bit of a crossover between medical coverage and Rx coverage and whether drugs should be covered under medical or whether those drugs can be covered under Rx. So you do have a little bit of flexibility if you're working with the PBM to make sure that you cover one under or special cover them under either medical or Rx and not necessarily both, so the plan can make sure they are collecting the specialty drugs and paying for them under the right bucket. Next, there's been quite a few questions about the employer mandate, especially when dependent children are also employees, as well as their parents, and whether or not a plan would be allowed to have an exclusion in the document that said that a dependent child who is an employee would not be allowed to have coverage also under their parent who is also an employee of that employer. And the answer to that is if you want to comply with the employer mandate, that would be problematic because there are certain rules about making sure that there is an offer of coverage not only for the individual employee but also for the dependent of that employee as well. And last but not least, we've been seeing a surge of actually at work provisions and questions. This has a little bit of an overlap with any potential stop loss issues, and we're actually going to be talking about later on leave of absences and how that can play into it. But Remember that if an individual, if a plan has an actively at work provision within their document, that doesn't necessarily mean that you can use that actively at work provision as a way to not allow that individual to enroll in coverage as of the day they would otherwise be at work. So if an individual has a 90-day waiting period under their plan, but they're not physically at work on day 90, that doesn't mean that you can't start their coverage on day 90. So that's just a quick overview of the different types of questions that we are most frequently seeing in June. Stay tuned for July.
Thanks, Jen. So we want to make sure that we talk about what are we going to discuss today. We're going to obviously focus on not only compliance, but also cost containment. So people ask all the time, well, what makes you guys different than this ERISA law firm we're using? The ERISA law firm can deal with the compliance, whether it's a state law, federal law, Department of Labor, et cetera. The difference between us and those firms is we bring in cost containment into the mix. So every time we discuss leave of absence, payable amounts, network carve-outs, and things in general, we're always discussing not only to how to make it compliant, but how to make it compliant in a cost-effective manner. So many times we'll have vendors contact us or people have ideas on, hey, I have a great way to save money. And we're like, yeah, you'd save a lot of money, but it's illegal. So that happens all the time. So just remember, we're looking at it from both a cost standpoint and a compliance standpoint when we discuss these things. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Ron to talk about some of the latest news, some of it good, some of it not so good. But we have a bunch of stuff to go over.
Yeah, it looks like I was assigned the bad news case, Saya v. Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan. Yes, I don't know how many people are aware of all the litigation and tangled web of appeals that have been going on, but I understand there's a lot of new news to share regarding the Tom Brady versus the NFL case. Oh, wait, that's not what we're talking about? Oh, right, okay. Saya versus Rick Snyder. This one is a little disappointing as well, at least as far as I'm concerned. What ended up happening here is Michigan passed a law where they would be collecting a tax on claims, health benefit claims that are being paid by self-funded plans and fully funded insurers alike. And in addition to the tax, there's also a lot of reporting and record-keeping requirements as well. And there was a general understanding amongst the self-funded community that this was going to seriously impact the self-funded benefit plans, not only from a cost perspective on the tax, but also on an administrative level as well, because of all this reporting and record-keeping that was part of the law. And SIA, on behalf of our industry, went and fought this and argued that there was ERISA preemption and then this law should not apply to these private self-funded ERISA plans. And they took it all the way to the Sixth Circuit. It was a lot of work, a lot of time that went into this. They made some excellent arguments. Unfortunately, they lost at that level, and they appealed to the Supreme Court. This is particularly relevant because at the same time, the Supreme Court had just decided the Gobio case, which was very similar in a lot of ways. And based on those similarities, the Supreme Court did remand this back to the Sixth Circuit and ordered them to reconsider and re-review the case in light of this new precedent.
And that's what gave a lot of people hope that this would be a different decision.
I looked at the filings and the arguments, and I mean, I don't know about you, but I felt that they were excellent, and I thought there was a very good chance based on this new precedent. Unfortunately, the Sixth Circuit didn't agree. I don't know if it was just
well, these judges want tax revenue.
You know,
everyone wants tax. If you're working for the government, you're going to want new tax revenue. So anything related to making money for the government.
It's Michigan, too, all right? So
money.
Somebody needs cash. Someone's hard up for cash. It's probably.
They're going to find a way to make a tax go through.
And, you know, I also understand, again, if you can imagine the Sixth Circuit, they look at this case and they're thinking, okay, we already told you that this is not preempted. You went above our heads to the Supreme Court. Now we're going to find other reasons to prove that we were right. Now, I may just be bitter. I may be a conspiracy theorist. Maybe they're right, and maybe this isn't preempted. But based on the arguments I saw, I thought it was an excellent argument. However, on a number of different slight differences between this and the Gobio situation, they've come up with a series of reasons why they feel that this is not preempted by ERISA. This is hot off the presses. It's relatively new. We'll find out what's going to happen moving forward. But at this point, what you should be prepared to do, if you are impacted by this law, be prepared to comply with it. And unfortunately, that's where we find ourselves at this time. And with that, I'm going to pass it on to Jen to share what I hope is better news. Jen?
Well, it's not necessarily better news. Sorry to say. So in the Flores case, one of the reasons why we're bringing this up, we don't typically talk about employee benefit issues that aren't necessarily 100% directly related to the plan, but as you all are probably aware and on the edge of your seats waiting for December 1st, the DOL has made some modifications to how overtime is to be handled for the remainder of this year and for 2017 going forward. And this case sort of aligns with that, so it really gives reason for employers to take a look at the benefits they're offering and making sure that there aren't going to be any concerns. Normally that would fall askew to this case, but also to what the DOL overtime rules are going to be. So here in this case, in the Flores case, the case was about some police officers who had alleged they had been underpaid for their overtime benefits because the city had made the decision to exclude cash payments that they had received in lieu of benefits. So the city here was offering a flexible benefits plan, and as part of the flexible benefits plan, the employees were given designated funds for dental, vision, and medical benefits. And while they had to use the funds to receive dental or vision benefits, they could use the medical benefits. They could opt out of that and instead just get cash instead of the benefits. And the city used for the individuals who decided to opt out of the medical, they decided to take that money and exclude it from calculating how they would decide what their overtime was. And the city decided that that was not a proper way to calculate what their salary should have been. So, and the moral of the story is, if you are an employer or if an employer does offer a flexible benefit plan and there are cash in lieu of benefits that are available, make sure that any amounts that were received as part of the cash in lieu of benefits are properly included when you're deciding whether or not overtime and how overtime should be calculated, particularly in light of the DOL's overtime rules. And John?
Thanks, Jen. The special surgery of Houston versus United Healthcare is an interesting case. It's nothing terribly novel, but it's worth mentioning just because it reiterates something that a lot of plans and TPAs have a problem with on what seems to us to be a daily basis. Because as Adam mentioned, through PGC Referral, our consulting channel, we receive tons of questions, and a lot of them have to do with, can you help us uphold this denial? And when we see denials that are just woefully inadequate, of course we can help, but the arguments are never going to be as strong as they would be had the denial been proper in the first place. So in this case, what happened is essentially, at a high level, an EOB was issued denying a claim. And the claim essentially said, this is denied, check your health plan. And the member said, well, what the heck does that mean? You know, my health plan is 120 pages. I don't know what I'm looking at. And the court 100% agreed with that participant. There have been numerous laws passed to make things simpler for participants. How about the example of an SBC? Has an SBC ever helped a plan participant?
Yeah,
absolutely. And when I meet that one guy, he'll tell me all about it. But in the meantime, it's just one example of something that the government has said has to be done, but is not terribly helpful for anyone. Putting the specific terms of the plan on an EOB is absolutely helpful. This is not, I repeat, not an example of something that is pointless. If the EOB doesn't say the exact terms of the plan that were relied on, it's very, very difficult to justify a denial. Lots of things are denied under the plan, but if you only give the justification, it's not covered, it's not going to cut it, it's not going to be adequate.
Well, you know, that's, I can tell you right now, a lot of times we hear from TPAs and from brokers that part of the reason why they have no way to actually build this into their system, which I don't really understand how that's even possible. But what we'll see many times is they'll actually have the right reason for the denial. So there is a proper reason. So the thinking of the administrator was correct. However, because every one of their plan docs is different, and they don't want to have different language for every EOB, they will have the same language for the denial reason, even though maybe only 5% of all their plans have that specific language within their plan doc.
Right, and of course, when new groups migrate to a TPA, they've got plan docs from their brokers, from their existing TPAs. One of the easiest ways to streamline this and make sure that it's easy as possible for a TPA to put language in their EOBs is to have all your plans on one plan doc template. Now, obviously, that's easier said than done, but there are good ways in the industry of getting one streamlined template and all your groups on it. And obviously, like I said, when new groups come to you, it's not exactly efficient to just rewrite their plans immediately, but on renewal, and the DOL has said, or the government has said, once every 3 years is about good to do a rewrite or a restate of the plan. Well, there's no reason to keep an old plan and just keep amending it. You might as well get them all on streamlined templates.
So the last news I want to bring up is actually an interesting video. If you've been on LinkedIn recently or even Twitter, or even if you received a copy of our newsletter that was sent out yesterday. By the way, if you do not get the Fiat newsletter and want one, feel free to email John. He'll make sure he hooks you up with that. However, we put out the video yesterday from the CEO of Leahy Health System, Dr. Howard Grant, and he actually discussed the fact that many residents of Massachusetts, where we are, receive great care. He talks about it. We all know that. But oftentimes, in the most costly way possible, very important for you to understand this, we have a CEO of a hospital acknowledging that, yeah, we give great care, but we're making this way too expensive. So there's a lot of really great points that he makes. I think a lot of the stuff that he's saying, many of us in the industry would nod our heads in agreement. But so he definitely goes a long way in talking about ways to reduce the cost of care, talking about the teaching hospitals, et cetera. We talked a little bit about the backroom dealings here in Massachusetts in regards to getting around the cost containment measures that we had in place from a transparency standpoint. But much of what he said must be applauded. So, again, if you want to have a link to that video, feel free to let myself or John know, and we'll make sure we get that newsletter out to you. Or if you happen to receive it already, it's right there at the beginning. You can click on this video and see the video for yourself. With that, I'm going to turn it back to Jen to talk about some of the regulatory updates that we've had that are pressing for this month.
Awesome. All right. So what's new? Lots of good stuff. So first of all, in early June, they released some new regulations. And in addition to talking about essential health benefits, these regulations also discussed accepted benefits and a little bit about expatriate plans. But for our discussions today, the thing that you guys should be aware of as it relates to the benefit documents specifically relates to essential health benefits for lifetime and annual limits. So within these regulations, it was reiterated that a group health plan, a self-funded plan, is not necessarily required to cover every single essential health benefit, but only that if they do, they have to make sure that there are no dollar limits and that the benefits that are covered by that plan are in line with the benchmark, the state benchmark that specific group chooses. So that means that a self-funded plan should be documented, should in some way have evidence of a state benchmark plan that they are selecting to decide what they are considering essential and what they are not considering essential. So there can be something somewhere that if there's ever discussion, if there's a dollar limit on a benefit, it can be documented, well documented, that there was a reason, there was some sort of guidance, some governing document the plan had relied upon when making a decision to consider something to be non-essential. So if you have a group that has that is in Massachusetts, for example, it's not necessarily true that the self-funded plan in Massachusetts must include the Massachusetts benchmark as their benchmark. You can opt to use a different state. There hasn't been any guidance that says that you cannot do that, but you have to use a benchmark to rely on deciding what is essential and what is not essential. Also, in addition to that, if you have a state that is maybe a non-ERISA plan, a governmental plan, and you want to make sure that they are not only complying with the essential health benefit rules, but the essential health benefits don't necessarily outline any of the state-mandated benefits. So if you have a non-ERISA plan, in addition to making sure that you are complying with the essential health benefit benchmarks, you also should cross-reference any of the benefits that are provided within your documents to make sure that you are also abiding by the state mandated benefits, because there is not necessarily an exact overlap between what a state essential health benefit benchmark plan is and what the state mandated benefits are. In addition to that, really exciting news here about colon cancer, there are some new tests and screenings. This is really a top,
exciting news about colon cancer.
Yeah, top to bottom coverage here at the Fiat Group about regulatory updates.
Top to bottom. All right.
Okay, so I killed myself. So under the task force, we know that for the preventive care mandates, that a non-grandfather plan is required to cover at 100% things that are listed on the task force websites that have certain ratings without any sort of co-payments or co-insurance. These recommendations are continually being changed and updated and modified, and there has been the notification that we should be, or employers should be, checking back on the website just to make sure on a yearly basis there haven't been any modifications or changes to these regulations and recommendations that would require a change to how we process benefits or how benefits are outlined within our documents. So since this is kind of an ongoing update to the task force list, the suggestion has been that you don't have to necessarily make these changes until the first year after these regulations have been updated. So it gives you a little bit of a lead time to kind of leeway time to make sure that you can actually review what the regulations require, or the recommendations require you to do, and actually make those changes to your systems and to your documents. So as it relates to this cancer screening, there are two new screenings that have been added as part of the task force list. It's the CT screening and some type of a FIT DNA type of test. So these tests, the benefit of having these screenings is that they are less invasive. But there is a little bit of a conflict about whether or not the screenings are required in addition to also having a test being required to be covered at 100% as well. So taking a look at what the actual regulations say versus what you're supposed to do in practice can be a little bit of a confusing issue. The same thing has happened with what does it mean if you have a vision screening versus a vision test. Under the preventive regulations, it's clear that you have to have a vision screening, but that doesn't necessarily mean that any and all eye doctor visits are covered. The same would be true here as far as what is being screened versus what the actual diagnostic test is required to be. And also, just as upcoming news, the BCORI deadline is August 31st. You may say, that's confusing. I thought it was July 31st. But have no fear, July 31st is a Sunday, so this year the filing deadline is actually on Monday, August 1st. And if you have questions about the BCORI fee, more specific questions, you can always reach out to us, and we'd be happy to help with those questions.
At pgcreferral@theagroup.com.
Great. All right, penalties, more good news. So the DOL also has outlined some of the new penalties that are required, not only for SBCs, but also for the Form 5500s. These have been making some recent news, the 5500s. People have been asking questions. Maybe they haven't really necessarily had to work with these or deal with these in the past, but previously the penalty for failing to file the 5500 was $1,100, but now it is $2,063 per day. So that is a substantial increase from what the failure to file the 5500 was in the past.
Can I ask you a question on this? Is it when you say failure to file, it's just filing, right? It's not that it's incomplete or incorrect.
Right.
Because many Form 5500s and SBCs are not completed correctly. So it's less about whether or not they're correct or not. It's more about the fact that you just filed.
Right. It's making sure that people aren't being negligent. So if you have an obligation to make a filing, to do a filing, to have these administrative processes in place, now's the time to make sure that you're doing, if you are required to file 5500, that you actually do it. It's okay if it's incomplete. It's okay if you need an extension. It's okay if you need to fix something. Just don't ignore it.
So just turn it in.
Turn it in.
Okay.
Do it. Next is for the group health plans. So the penalty for failing to give the SBC used to be $1,000, and now this is increased by a whopping $87. So now it's $1,087 for failing to provide that. So what's the point? Why are you telling me this? I'm telling you this because the penalties are continuing to increase because they have seen over the years that it doesn't seem like the penalties in the past were actually acting as a deterrent, people failing to comply. So as efforts to make sure that people are going to comply, they have increased the penalties.
And that extra $87, oh boy.
It will continue to increase over time, I expect, as well. Math is not my strong suit, so if you ask me for the formula for how these increased penalties are being calculated, I don't know the answer. Okay, and also talking about SBCs, there were some new FAQs that were just released about a week or so ago. The thing that's important about the SBC regular FAQs that were released is it gives us a little bit of a time frame or an idea about how exactly and when exactly the SBC, the new 2017 really exciting templates, are supposed to be used. So at first, we thought it was just directly for the first plan year after April 1st, 2017. But based on our reading of these FAQs, it actually seems like the 2017 SBC template materials are supposed to be used as of the first day of the first open enrollment period that begins on or after April 1st, 2017. So that could be a month, 2 months, 3 months, actually earlier than the April 1, 2017 deadline that we originally thought. So keep in mind how that should be handled. As far as the HSA limits, these limits have been changed slightly for 2017. The out-of-pocket has actually stayed the same at $6,550 for individuals and $13,100 for families. We do know that if you have a HSA high deductible plan, that the annual deductible for plans needs to be at least $1,300 for self only and $2,600 for family coverage. So we'll keep a lookout on those. Just those are things that are obviously are increased or looked at on an annual basis as far as how we're supposed to be handling our HSA plans and how this would relate to our high deductible type plans. And last but not least, this is a case, while it is a couple of months old, it is important to discuss to make sure that this is something that people are aware of. There have been other things in the news recently about churches and whether or not they're entitled to exemptions or accommodations about contraceptives, but this kind of gives us a little bit of an opportunity to discuss really who is a religious organization. So in this case, in the Seventh Circuit, there was a issue where a church-affiliated hospital, so it was an affiliated hospital.
A nonprofit hospital.
Well, nonprofit hospital. And this nonprofit hospital, religious-affiliated, church-affiliated hospital, had a benefits plan. And there was an issue about whether or not this church-affiliated plan actually was required to comply with ERISA. And the argument was that since they were a church-affiliated organization, that they would be exempt from the ERISA requirements because they're a church, and there's a church exemption under ERISA, right? Well, not necessarily the case. So here, reading how ERISA has established and maintained a church plan, what the definition of a church plan is, the Seventh Circuit decided to read that and interpret the ERISA statute to say that the words established and the words maintained are going to be key in the determination of whether or not you are subject to an ERISA or to being an ERISA-type plan. And you'd only be exempt if you had a plan that was maintained or established by a church. And since this was a church-affiliated hospital, it was not necessarily established or maintained by the church. So this is going to be important for the types of group documents that you have, maybe as persuasive, not necessarily binding, particularly if you're not in the Seventh Circuit, and taking a look at those documents and seeing, are there groups that you have that are claiming to be churches when they're not necessarily church organizations? If that's the case, then maybe it's a good time to take a look at the language, and if there's not ERISA language in that document, it's time for that document to get updated.
So an example would be a church-affiliated university or college.
Right.
Like Notre Dame, I'm assuming, is a church-affiliated university, right? So you obviously have the name of that case if people have, because we get questions from people asking us what the name of the case is. If anybody wants to reach out to us for a site, we can give them that, because I think it is a very interesting question, because what the Seventh Circuit did was it had a very narrow approach into it. So just that's important to know.
Yeah, the name, so the center that was involved was Advocate. And I'll turn it over to Ron.
Great. All right. Leaves of absence. You know, this slide makes me want to take a break, but I only just started, so we'll have to wait till later. You know, we've been talking about minding the gap and gaps in coverage for many, many years at this point. It seems like yesterday we started talking about it, but it's actually been a number of years. And at the time, we really focused in on the gap between a plan document and their stop-loss policy. And at the time, that was where our concern lies, that a plan would pay claims and then not be able to obtain reimbursement from their stop loss because of a difference in verbiage or a difference in coverage between the two. And, you know, to the industry's credit, you know, again, this is still a problem in some places, but we've certainly seen efforts being made by some carriers and some TPAs and plans and brokers and those who are involved to try and get those documents to mesh, to mirror, and not just in words, but also in the interpretation of those words. So kudos to everybody who's been involved in that and closing that gap. But even though the stop-loss policy and the plan document may be closer in interpretation and definition and no longer have a gap between them as far as coverage is concerned, unfortunately what we've discovered are other documents and other policies in play that are creating gaps that maybe we didn't recognize or see as clearly until the gap between stop-loss and the plan was closed. And one of the biggest areas of concern that we're seeing has to do with employment policies, contracts, hiring contracts, and employer policies regarding things like a leave of absence. One of the sort of the key issues whenever you look at any kind of a coverage item is eligibility, right? Is the person covered by the plan? Are their claims covered by the plan? And the problem is that the plan document may define eligibility a certain way. Someone who's actively at work for a certain amount of time, they're not allowed to be away from the office for more than a certain period of time. The problem is this employer has a policy or a handbook or an employment contract that has completely different terms. And amongst other things, it indicates that you're allowed to be away from work if you're on approved leave of absence for a certain period of time that far exceeds the time you're allowed to be away from work from the plan document. So the problem is the plan document says this person shouldn't be covered. The stop loss only covers the plan, and the stop loss agrees. They mirror each other. There's no gap there, so they think this person's claim shouldn't be covered. But meanwhile, the employer and the employee think this person's claims are still covered because of the leave of absence rule or the handbook or the policy or the contract that that employer has with the employee. And one of the biggest concerns that I have when I look at something like this is that even though it's true that the person no longer meets the eligibility requirements under the plan so that their claims should be denied by the plan, and take note, if the plan makes an exception and pays the claim, chances are stop loss isn't going to reimburse. So even though that plan is allowed to deny, that employee could turn around and demand that the employer pay the claims. Not the plan, but the employer. Because that employment contract, that handbook, that leave of absence policy that that employer has with their employees, that's a separate independent contract that that employer has with their employees.
Right, and that's not covered by stop loss.
That's not covered by stop loss.
Right.
So hopefully, you know, you've got some sort of E&O or something like that.
So I had a, you know, this brings up two big points to me, Ron, and I don't know what's happened in the past month, but I can tell you one of the things I know is over the since our last webinar, I have seen many of these leave of absence issues come to our desks. Mm. Right now, I'm almost advising our legal team, if we're asked to do a gap review between a plan and a stop-loss policy, just find out if there is an employee handbook or some type of contract with that employee, and just get that too.
Yeah.
Because what I'm concerned about is we're doing a gap analysis, and we tell our client, yep, there's no gaps, you're good to go, but then we never asked for and didn't inquire about an employee handbook or an employee contract that might have something different. So recently, in the past couple weeks, I actually had a very big case I've been working on relating to a specific retirement agreement that an employee had that said that the employee and his spouse were going to be covered by the plan up until a certain period of time. These kinds of scenarios where the plan, the employer, is agreeing to offer health insurance coverage to an employee and their family, yet they're not covered under the employee benefit plan based on the eligibility rules. Therefore, no stop loss policy is going to reimburse based on that, they're going to reimburse based on the eligibility rules of the plan doc.
Right.
Well, of course, because this is what happens, right? That person or persons who is still entitled to some type of health insurance coverage gets really sick. And the claims go well above spec. And then you have everyone and their mother calling us to see what we can do about that going forward. This is an example. Just get all the contracts and all the policies in front of you so that when you do decide to work with the stop-loss carrier, maybe you can negotiate insurance coverage for those people or do some type of buyout program or buyout process so that you can actually just pay that particular employee and or their family a stipend, a dollar amount, so they can purchase their own insurance on the exchanges or just on private insurance so that they're not subject to the plan isn't subject to any potential risk or exposure because of no stop loss being available.
Yeah. The other thing I just want to add too, Ron, is that just because an employer wants to extend a leave of absence to that individual employee doesn't mean that they must also extend health plan coverage. So right. We're not necessarily saying that you must extend both or you don't have to extend both. You can certainly allow for a leave of absence and not also allow for continuation coverage. So it's really important to clarify what the actual intent is.
Yeah,
well,
I think ultimately it boils down to this philosophy, and I don't know where it came from, that the employer and the plan are one and the same. When the employer wants to pay something, that means the plan is going to pay it. Or if the employer wants to extend a leave, that means the plan is going to extend coverage. The employer and the plan are two separate entities. If the employer wants to use its assets and its money to pay somebody's medical bills out of the goodness of their heart, out of their pocket, go for it. But that doesn't mean that the plan is going to cover it, and that certainly doesn't mean stop loss is going to reimburse. If an employer wants to extend a leave of absence above and beyond what the plan document envisions as a person being away from employment, so be it. But that doesn't mean that the plan is automatically going to extend as well. Understanding that the employer and what the employer does and does not do is independent and separate from the plan and what the plan will and will not do, and by extension, stop loss, is the key to understanding this issue.
John?
Thank you.
Welcome. All right.
That's polite. One of my favorite topics, payable amounts. It's an issue that health plans using networks deal with very, very frequently, actually, more frequently than I would care to say. The one main takeaway, if you take away nothing else from the next two slides, the one main takeaway is do not violate, please do not violate your PPO contracts. If there is a negotiated rate, that is the rate that should be paid in every instance. In a rare instance that a PPO contract gives you the right to audit claims and pay them at less than the predefined network rate, fantastic. By all means, do whatever you can do under the contract, because as we all know, even network negotiated rates are still not exactly fair market value or favorable to the plan. That being said, if you sign an agreement to pay a certain rate, you have to pay that rate. So what we say is that negotiated rates are the be-all and end-all. So if there's a negotiated rate, don't have your plan say, we will audit every claim based on clinical criteria and bundling, things like that. If it's subject to a PPO, you typically cannot do that. Probably 99% of the time, PPO contracts don't allow that type of auditing. When it comes to the SPD and the PPO contract, make sure they're in line. Simply put, make sure that the SPD doesn't say anything that the PPO contract doesn't allow. One thing that we see all the time is when the plan has an exclusion for any amount in excess of UNC, usual and customary. And then, of course, usual and customary is defined as the prevailing charges in the area. So in other words, for every claim, in-network, out-of-network, doesn't matter. For every claim, the plan caps payment at what other providers in the area charge. Well, if there's a network contract, that might not work out every time. If the network rate happens to be more than providers usually charge, the plan has a choice. The plan can either follow the network contract or the plan can follow the plan document. Obviously, the instinct is to follow the plan document. But that being said, networks are large. Networks are powerful. Hospital systems are large and powerful as well. They've got in-house counsel. They will write you nasty letters, and they will follow up on them. They won't just go away. If the choice is violating the plan or violating the contract, obviously, it's not a good choice to have. We certainly recommend having your plan doc reviewed to make sure that there's nothing in the PPO contract that contradicts anything in the plan. But if given the choice, I would say the plan offers less pushback, because think about it. Even if it technically is a breach of your fiduciary duty, which, of course, like I said, is a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad thing, plan participants are probably not going to sue you for paying too much. For their lack of balanced billing, they're probably not going to sue you. That being said, it's a very bad choice to have to begin with, so do whatever you can to make sure your plan doc and PPO contract are in sync.
Hey, John, I don't know if this was just a happy coincidence or if this was planned by you. If so, well done. But, you know, this ties right back to the previous slide, which is, again, that people don't understand the difference between the employer and the plan. The thing is, I hear this all the time where, you know, the employer went and signed off on a network contract that says they're going to pay a certain amount within a certain period of time, no questions asked. And then the plan document says, oh, no, you know, we can't pay more than this amount. And they're basically saying, well, I'm just going to ignore the contract because the plan document is the ultimate decision maker on how much the plan is going to pay. And that statement is actually true. The plan document does dictate how much the plan is going to pay. The problem is, like you said, these networks or providers, what they'll end up doing is they're going to say, fine, we'll take the most that the plan's allowed to pay. We understand the fiduciary duty. We understand the plan terms and the max allowable. And we'll just sue the employer for the remainder because it's the employer who signed the contract, not the plan. That's a frightening idea. The fact is they're not appealing. They're not asking for more plan money. They're not going through the administrative appeals process. What they're doing is they're looking to enforce an independent separate contract against an independent separate entity, that being the employer. So if employers think that they can enter into contracts and then use the plan as an excuse to ignore those contracts, they're going to get themselves into some big trouble.
A couple things I want to bring up. In regards to the SPD lining up with the PPO contract, we all know that's pretty much almost impossible many times. However, when you purchase your stop-loss policy, you want to make sure that you somehow define in there that if there is an in-network claim in the stop-loss policy, you can put add a provision on the page one stating that if in-network claims will be paid based on in-network rates and the in-network contract. that will alleviate a lot of the issues that we see on a monthly basis. We probably shouldn't be telling you that because it's less money for us, right, less work for us. But for the industry as a whole, it's going to benefit you in that regard. And second, in regards to the percentage of Medicare issue that Ron and John have been talking about, one of the key things to bring up here is be very careful of how you write what you put down in the plan document, how much you're willing to pay based on a percentage. Because if you ever go above and beyond that for a specific negotiation, you could also put yourself in a predicament when it comes to your stop loss. So these are all things that you could discuss with your carrier prior to actually signing a contract with them if you happen to have a reference-based plan or some type of carve-out. John?
Yeah, thanks, Adam. And that actually brings me to my next point here. We've been talking about stop loss and gaps, and especially Ron when he was talking about leaves of absence. There is scarcely a larger gap with stop loss than when it comes to payable amounts. Take, for example, an urban area. There are 10 hospitals. They all charge basically the same things except for one that charges three times what all those other ones do. It's got a big name. It's got a lot of popularity. Patients love to go there because under their plan, the max is still the max for out-of-pocket, that is. So they feel that they're going to get the best care from the most expensive provider, the one they see in the commercials, right? So when the plan says that it will pay what other area providers pay, and when the stop-loss policy says that all it will pay is what other area providers pay, when the patient goes to that one facility that charges three times what all other area providers pay, or charge rather, that's going to be a problem for the plan, and it's going to be a problem for stop-loss. Now, with the plan, there are things you can do about it. There are language modifications you can make. There are always changes you can make to the plan. But when it comes to stop-loss, as we all know, it's not quite so easy. There are a lot of carriers that are very forward-thinking and that are willing to work with plans on things like this because, obviously, in certain areas, certain concessions need to be made and plan document language should be taken into account. But there are many more carriers that will just say, no, our policy terms are our policy terms. We're not going to pay whatever rates you deem are reasonable. We're not going to let you just send patients to the most expensive hospitals imaginable. We're going to pay what other area providers charge. And if one provider happens to charge three times as much, tough. Deal with it. Obviously, it's not ideal, but it's worth a discussion with the stop-loss carrier to make sure or to try to make sure that something can be done when something like that happens. And Adam also mentioned what we were going to get into, the percentage of Medicare. We actually get a ton of questions regarding how a carve-out or reference-based pricing plan should be structured. The questions are usually having to do with basically the plan wants to pay, say, 150% of Medicare for a given claim or even for all claims. But let's take, for example, a dialysis carve-out. The plan wants to pay 150%, but the plan also wants to put language in there saying, but if the provider won't accept 150%, we are willing to negotiate up to 200%. Now, I personally hate that language. I think that language is just a terrible idea.
Because you're telling the hospital, if they ask for a copy of the plan, what your maximum payment is.
Exactly. Exactly. And
why tell them that?
Well, the theory behind it, the why in that is stop loss. Plans think that, you know, if the plan says 150 and they go up to 200, stop loss is going to say, well, no, you said 150, so we're only going to pay 150. Well, yes, typically that is the case. But we have seen a huge amount of success talking to stop loss. There's one key theme when it comes to stop loss. Talk to your carrier. Discuss it with them. Don't wait till problems happen. If you talk to the carrier and you say, hey, carrier, here's what we want to do. We want to pay 200 maximum, but we're going to say 150 to give us some negotiation leverage. The carrier can absolutely underwrite that plan based on 200. It doesn't matter what the plan says. If the carrier wants to do 200, something can be added to the schedule in the policy to specify that. It's not that big a deal. But the absolute last thing you want to do is tell providers your end game. You don't want them to know your negotiation strategies before you get started. It ruins your leverage. And, of course, as Adam mentioned, if you're going to negotiate above that 150, make sure the plan gives you authority to do that because anything you negotiate above that is going to be a stop-loss problem, and it's going to be technically taxable to the employee unless the plan specifically provides for negotiated rates. Now, auditing criteria. This is an issue that we have had numerous times over the past few months, and I know that we've talked about it in webinars, but it keeps coming up. Simply put, when your plan document says, usual and customary is defined as the prevailing charge in the area, and then you send the claim out to a clinical auditor who looks at all sorts of factors. That is not allowed by the terms of that plan document. When a provider, or worse, a network, when someone pushes back and says, show me where you're allowed to do this, and you send them the plan doc language that says the prevailing charges in the area, you've just defeated yourself. You've made their argument for them. You're fighting a losing battle.
So basically what John's saying is, even though for years we've been talking about making sure your SPD is perfect, and you put a lot of emphasis on it, we just keep seeing over and over again our self-funded clients, our self-funded employee benefit plans, basically shooting themselves in the foot because, one, they're telling the provider the maximum they're willing to pay in writing. Two, they're telling the provider they don't have a right to do any audit, yet the number one reason for the reduction in the amount the plan wants to pay is based on a clinical or some type of audit done by an outside firm that they don't even have a right to do.
Right. It's a problem.
And it just keeps happening over and over again.
Right. Next item
even
here.
Even plans last year didn't have the language. We told them last year to change it. They renew this year, still don't have that language. So we're asking now, especially since it is July, if you, when you, now that you're renewing your clients, you're going up and you're trying to pick out these, whether they're 9-1s or 1-1s for 2017, please, this is where, again, if you're not willing to restate, if you only have one or two small amendments, this is where a quick amendment to your plan would not take a long time. We're talking about a page of language can be added and amended to the plan that will easily save you, potentially, on one claim, a couple $100,000 in plan savings, on one claim.
Right.
So, thanks. Sorry, John.
No, no, not at all. The next item on our list here is wrap networks. Now, I am not going to get deep into those.
We're going to talk about it next month.
We do want you to tune in on August 23rd, and if I talk too much about it now, you'll have no reason, because you'll say, well, I know it all already. Simply put, if you've got wrap networks, which you all do, don't lie, if you've got wrap networks or out-of-network claims, you are getting pounded by providers. That's just the case. The plan's expenses are skyrocketing, and wrap networks are not exactly an amazing way to contain costs. If you've got questions, if you've got wrap networks and you're paying more than you want to pay, which, like I said, you all are, contact us.
Well,
we've got some ideas.
What we're going to do for next month's webinar on wrap networks is we're actually going to take actual contracts that are out there. We obviously can't say who the carriers are, but we will go over actual contracts telling you these are the areas that you can change. This is what you can do. So when you get that $1 million claim and want to apply that 10% discount on it, we will tell you next month a step-by-step procedure and process you can put in place. So instead of spending $900,000 on that claim, you are paying $300,000 on that same claim with sign-off. What you can and cannot do so that you make sure your stop-loss carrier's involved, your plan's involved, your broker realizes how great you are, and everyone makes out in these situations. John?
Now, last but not least, I'm going to touch kind of quickly on discrimination. And the concerns regarding discrimination and payable amounts are maybe not directly intuitive, but it does come up a lot of the time in the context of claim negotiation. One of them is mental health parity. The regulations, and obviously if you've got any questions about mental health parity, feel free to email PGC referral. The regulations provide, in general, and this is an enormous summarization, the regulations provide that mental health benefits need to be paid at the same amount as medical and surgical benefits. That is, of course, if the plan covers mental health benefits. That's a whole other issue. But basically, we've had people reach out to us and say, we would like to negotiate a mental health claim, but we're concerned that it might violate the parity rules. And my answer to that is absolutely 100% not the case. The mental health parity rules, and again, I'm not going to get into too great detail, but the mental health parity rules concern how much the patient is going to pay out of pocket for mental health claims. Obviously, they're concerned about how much the plan is going to pay, but when it comes to a negotiation, if the provider accepts a negotiation and the patient is not being balance billed, what's the concern? There's no discrimination. Who cares about mental health parity as long as everyone is happy?
It's a different story if you're only willing to pay X and the patient's getting balance billed the difference, then you have a parity issue.
Right. But if you're negotiating and the provider signs off and the patient is not being balance billed any more than what the plan provides in terms of deductible, coinsurance, and copay, fantastic. No issues whatsoever. And another issue that comes up very briefly, different amounts for different claimants. Two claimants, for example, incur $20,000 bills at different providers. and this is what I'm talking about here is straight claim negotiation, no reference-based pricing, no carve-outs, nothing. If both claims are negotiated and the one provider agrees to accept 10,000, one provider agrees to accept 5,000, are you discriminating against either provider or either patient? Absolutely not. Just like with mental health parity, the patient's happy, the provider's happy, assuming, of course, the provider does actually agree to the negotiation, and the plan pays that. The patient is no worse off in either instance because the out-of-pocket would be exactly only what the plan says and no balance billing, no discrimination, you're good to go.
If your purpose in having a network is to have a contractual prohibition on balance billing, and you want your employees to be able to go to any provider in the entire country and know that they'll never be balance billed, then by all means use a large network or RAB networks and know that your employees can go anywhere and they won't be balance billed. You're going to pay through the nose. Your discounts are going to be non-existent. And it's not the network's fault and it's not the provider's fault. And I know the knee-jerk reaction is to sometimes bash hospitals and networks, but if you look at it from their perspective, you know, what does a provider value, right? Steerage, exclusivity, prompt payment, electronic payment, maybe a liaison in your office that they have dedicated to them to communicate. Those are the types of things, the type of value, the type of consideration that a provider wants, and rightfully so. It sounds great. But if you have every single hospital in the country in such an arrangement, you can't possibly provide those things, especially steerage. So there is almost an inverse relationship between the value of the network from the perspective of discounts and prices paid with the size of the network. A more exclusive, narrow network is by virtue going to also result in better rates because those providers enjoy some exclusivity. It's important to understand that relationship because you can't have your cake and eat it too. I'm sorry to be the one to tell you that. So moving forward, if your instead value is partially on a contractual prohibition on balance billing, but also trying to get the most out of the relationship with those providers that are most important to you, you're going to need to reconsider how you have your network structured.
The bottom line is the regional and smaller networks are much more willing to allow carve-outs than the national networks. It's pretty simple as that. So what we have seen is many of these smaller networks stating, okay, you want to carve out dialysis? No problem. We won't include dialysis providers within our network. Not an issue for your particular plan. That's what we've seen the most bang for the buck, as well as with the physician-only networks as well. So with that, we'll turn it back over to Jen to talk about, in general, some of the additional requirements that we're looking at.
I'm just going to go over this pretty quickly. So the first is talking about translation requirements. So in general, there are certain rules that require that if you have a certain number of participants, so if you have over 100 participants, then generally if 10% of the population is fluent in another non-English language, then there are certain qualifications for being able to provide those individuals translation-related assistance as it relates to what their benefits are. So it's not necessarily required under ERISA that you actually have a plan document written in translation, but just available to those participants is maybe a fluent speaker or telephonic services or something where anyone who speaks a non-English language is able to understand what their benefits are.
Here's one thing we've actually found out, Jen, about the translation services too, is that it's expensive.
It is expensive.
To get these plan docs translated, I mean, people come to us and say, what? I'm like, listen, we're just the middleman. We're not even upcharging on this. This is what we're being told by the various companies that we work with, and we work with a lot of them.
Right.
Because we have employers all across the country with different language needs. But it's an expensive proposition to get your plan document translated in another language.
It is actually cheaper to have it translated than to have somebody who's fluent in that language on staff, however. So
right.
there are pros and cons. So
agreed.
You can take a look at your bottom line. Next, SMMs and SMRs. So the difference here, an SMM is a material modification to your document, and SMR is a reduction in coverage. So if you modify your documents and you need an amendment, you have 210 days at the close of the plan year to provide that notice. If you are reducing benefits, the SMR, then you have 60 days after you adopt that change. And this correlates with the SBC rules, to a certain extent. If you have a SBC-related change, you are going to have to have a provide notice to the participants 60 days advance of that actual change. Next is the Medicare issues and discrimination. So lately we've been seeing certain ways where plans are trying to be creative in how they are containing their costs, but at the expense of potentially violating Medicare. So anytime you put in limitations or references to Medicare, whether it's for dialysis or whether it's an age requirement, there are potentially Medicare Secondary Payer Act concerns. So that is something to be aware of and make sure that if you are putting certain provisions in the document, they don't violate Medicare itself.
John? And then last thing I want to make sure I bring up on the TPA versus ASO, understand really quickly, before you or your broker start redlining and commenting on your current plan doc, find out if you're allowed to make any type of modifications to your plan based on your concurrent administrative service agreement, because many times, particularly in the ASO environment, you are not allowed to modify the terms of the plan doc on your own other than maybe a schedule of benefits.
Ron? So anytime you have a duty, usually there's two questions to ask. One, what is my duty? And two, is somebody going to enforce it against me? Is someone going to hold me to it? And, you know, since ERISA's passage, the idea of a fiduciary duty on plan administrators has existed. The issue has just been that nobody's really held your feet to the fire as far as enforcement is concerned. But that's changing. And we're starting to see now plan members, employers, they're looking to their brokers, their advisors, their third-party administrators. And not only are they deeming them to be fiduciaries, but they're also holding them responsible for how those assets are being spent, making sure that they're being used prudently. And, I mean, just as an example, if there's money out there and it belongs to the plan and somebody says, hey, look, you can invest $50 today and recover $100 for the plan tomorrow, and you say, yeah, but you know, that sounds like a lot of work. I'm just going to let it go. Maybe that worked in the past, but now the one that's supposed to benefit from that $100, they're going to come looking for it, and they're going to come after you if they don't get it. Overpayment recoveries, how much you're paying, accessing discounts. If there's an option, a service, something you can do to reduce the amount of expenditure a plan is suffering or increase the amount of money that's coming back to the plan, and you don't look into it, at the very least, do a cost-benefit analysis, and somebody finds out that you didn't do that on their behalf, that's neither prudent nor enforcement of your fiduciary obligation, and you may be held liable. So the time has come to start looking at what's out there to help the plan secure its assets, retain, reduce costs, increase, maximize benefits, minimize those costs, and thereby protect the plan.
So with that, we want to say thank you to everybody. Join us on our next webinar, which we discuss on August 23rd at 1 o'clock Eastern Time. We're going to get in-depth in regards to wrap networks, help you and your clients save big money. We got about 30 seconds left, so there's a bunch of questions that we received. I'm going to focus on a couple of them. One, we will get you the Seventh Circuit site. We'll email you. Second, SBCs, if they issue timely, but you find out they're incorrect, is there a penalty? We discussed this. There is no penalty as long as you're being reasonable in your efforts in trying to put the SBC together and submit it in a timely manner. So like we said, just like homework in high school, just turn it in. Next question was in relation to SMMs. If the benefits and coverage remain the same, however, the insurance carrier changes, that one's pretty rare, right? You're changing, you have the same exact benefits, different carriers, is that considered an SMM?
So the answer is this is really going to depend on what's in the document. So you're really amending what's in the document. So most often you see this change if you're changing PBMs, for example. So if your plan document doesn't necessarily reference the PBM, but there is a change to the carriers, there's not necessarily going to be a need to make a modification or SM for that change. It really just depends what's in the document. You only need to modify what is in the document.
So with that, I want to say thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in today. It's great to have the size of the audience that we had, even though it's the middle of the summertime. On behalf of Jen, John, Ron, and myself, see you next month and enjoy your summer. Bye-bye.